Welcome to Choose Wisely. This is the podcast where we deconstruct food and sustainability topics with nuance and primary sources. Here we believe there are lots of right ways to eat well and that we can't change a food system we don't truly understand. I'm your host, Caroline Nelson, and it is spring and it feels so good. On the farm, we've been lambing, and we're actually almost done with lambing season. We've got 100 or so lambs running around outside. The grass is growing. Everything is turning green. I mean, it's Montana, so it's still slightly windy and brutal outside, but we are so close to warm weather, and I'm feeling so good. I'm 6 weeks postpartum-ish, and it just feels like my body is kind of coming back to life at the same time that the ground and the land around me is, and the trees and the bushes. I want to thank you all for the kind words and support around our episode last week. That's when I shared our home birth story. The full episode went up on Patreon, and we have a lot of new regenerators to welcome as a result. So I'd like to welcome Shelby, Casey, Jesse, Alyssa, Gail, Katie, Willa, Kabai, Justin, Julie, Madeline, Healy, Jillian, Morgan, Sky, Karini, Isabel, and Jenner. Thank you so much for joining us over on the Patreon. And thank you to everyone who listened and just for being able to hear it with nuance and without judgment. It was really joyful for me to get to share that whole journey with you last week. On today's episode, we have Mariah Gladstone, who is Blackfeet and Cherokee and grew up in Northwest Montana. She graduated from Columbia University with a degree in environmental engineering and returned home, where she developed IndigiKitchen, a resource dedicated to revitalizing Indigenous food systems knowledge. Mariah has been recognized as a Loose Indigenous Knowledge Fellow through the First Nations Development Institute, a Culture of Health Leader through the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and an MIT Solve Indigenous Communities Fellow. Mariah completed her master's degree at SUNY ESF through the Center for Native Peoples and the Environment. Mariah is a botanist. She is an expert in many things. She's also one of those people that you want to just like have a drink with and sit around the table and just chat and have like a really, really wide-ranging conversation, because I think the thing that I really resonate with her is that she sees the interconnectedness of all these systems. And, you know, on one hand, we're talking about food, then we're talking about, you know, politics, and it just, everything is woven together. And I just so appreciate the way that she reframed some ideas for me, particularly around the concept of food deserts. I so appreciate the way that we talked about really how food was a tool of colonization, and she really expanded my mind in that area. And we go all the way to the Irish potato famine by the end of this conversation. So please enjoy Mariah Gladstone, and you'll find all of her links in the show notes. And I really highly recommend that you check them out. Today's episode is brought to you by G5 Insurance. And if you're a rancher, farmer, or a small business owner, I want you to listen up, because G5 Agency insures everything that we do at Little Creek. These are our insurance agents, and they've been with us since the very beginning. I deal with a lot of different businesses through our work, and I am constantly blown away by how different it is working with G5. I feel like they actually know us. They're invested in us. They care about us. It feels like a very old-fashioned, personalized experience. Our agent will call me to check in. They will even send me a DM on Instagram. If I have any questions, I just know, I'm gonna run this by Eric, or I'm gonna shoot Lorraine an email. And they have really stayed with us as we've grown and really facilitated the growth of our business. Our insurance needs are complex. We're on a farm, we have heavy equipment, we work with livestock, we ship perishable food products, we run tourism events on different ranches with large animals, and we have business vehicles. Like, if you know anything about insurance, you know what a feat it is that we love our agents. G5 G5 wasn't daunted by any of our needs. I am ride or die at this point, and I highly recommend them to anyone out there in need of business insurance. G5 can write in 48 states and has years of experience working with farms, ranches, and small businesses. You can find them at g5agency.com. So to kick off, if you can picture yourself just in the middle of nowhere, Montana, I say that with air quotes, middle of nowhere. Let's say you're in this expansive grassland, maybe at the base of some mountains, there's a stream nearby, trees, shrubs. What food might secretly surround you that most people have no idea is there?
Ooh, I think there's so many different wild foods. You know, just here on the Blackfeet Reservation, we have 14 different types of edible berries, but those are pretty obvious. You know, berries are brightly colored. Mm-hmm. They're pretty easy to identify. There's wild greens, which I think can be a little bit more difficult for people to find. You know, there are things like stinging nettle. There are things like dandelion greens, plantains, fireweed, which is pretty obvious. It's a flower, but you can steam the shoots like asparagus in the springtime. Just a fun, beautiful plant to have. You can just take the flowers and decorate salads with them. And I think if I'm doing really bougie events, fireweed flowers on top make a great decoration. Similarly, glacier lilies. Glacier lilies are gorgeous. One of the first flowers after the snow melts. Those flowers are edible. Snack on a glacier lily next time you're passing by. But I think the plants that no one thinks about when they think about wild foods are like the root vegetables, which are definitely the hidden gems. And it's like, oh, you have to know what you're looking for on the surface to know what you're going to dig for that you're eating. So in Montana, we obviously have camas. Camas is a beautiful blue flower, and we have meadows that bloom kind of in the mountains and those wetter kind of foothill areas and then higher elevations as well. We have all of these camas fields, and the bulbs themselves are really high in inulin. And inulin is a compound that's hard for your body to digest. And so you actually have to slow cook these camas bulbs to break down the inulin into delicious sugars. Traditionally, people would dig them after they went to seed because the nutrients went back down into the bulb. Also, death camas is a thing. Mm-hmm. The flowers for death camas are white. The flowers for blue camas are blue. And I've seen them growing right next to each other before. Often they grow in slightly different climates, but I've seen them blooming right next to each other. So be aware of what you're looking for if you're going to go dig camas. But there's other root vegetables that we have too.
I was going to ask you about death camas.
Yeah, death camas. One bulb will kill you, so know what you're doing. There are lots of other root vegetables that we have in Montana. Of course, we have like biscuit root, which is, we have fern leaf biscuit root and nine leaf biscuit root. They're in the Lomatium genus. And like the name says, like you can harvest them and then grind the roots down into a flour and make biscuits or use that flour to thicken soups and stews with. Prairie turnips or Petimonium esculenta is basically like a low glycemic potato. It's a legume. It grows on the prairies in sandy, well-drained soils. So root vegetables. And then we also have things like yampa, which is also called double root. Yampa tastes exactly like carrots. It's in that carrot family. So I always tell people, be really sure of whatever you're harvesting in that carrot family. Is it something delicious like yampa? Or is it poison hemlock? These things are important to know. But yeah, good things to know because you may die or you may get a delicious wild carrot. Up to you. Know your plants.
Oh my gosh. There's so much that we have lost. I could identify a carrot. I know like one, you know, if you asked me to list root vegetables, I would list you like three vegetables that are, I would guess, 100% introduced to this continent and have no concept of all of these foods around us and how to prepare them. You know, it's only been recently that I've been getting into my like plant journey. I'm in my like plant era now where I'm starting to really appreciate, because what I was realizing is like I was going out into nature, and I sort of don't like talking about nature in that way of like you go out into nature. I feel like it's creates this idea that nature is like out there. But anyway, when I would go out of my home and into less tamed places, I was like, I can't speak the language here. I don't know what I'm looking at. All I can say is like, it's pretty. I had no sense of whether it was healthy, you know. So anyway, it's been really fun, like starting to go down the journey of what's edible, what's medicinal. And yeah, just feeling like I'm more at home. It's like brought me closer to the landscape, which of course it would. But anyway, okay. So in your TED talk, you said a lot of really interesting things. One of which was that pre-contact, a Blackfeet man might have consumed 7.5 pounds of bison meat per day on a raw meat basis, fresh meat basis. I am so fascinated by that. And one of the things you just mentioned is that the roots that are native to here would have had a lower glycemic index. So I was wondering whether you could talk about, like, you do a lot of work around the colonization of diet that happened to Indigenous peoples and how that speaks to health and speaks to like all kinds of things today.
Yeah. So that statistic, about 7.5 pounds of meat, came from George Kipp, who is an elder, a Blackfeet elder here and a state legislator. And he's the one that told me that at the time. And I think that that also has a lot of variation based on the season and of course what people were doing and how much movement people were conducting. But also when you think about the ways in which meat was being eaten, there wasn't a way of storing a ton of meat. So when you harvest meat, you have a couple days where you can have fresh meat, right? Even in higher temperatures, you can hang meat and still get away with it before it spoils for a couple days, right? Mm-hmm. But what people were doing was obviously drying the meat out. And obviously we didn't have like preservation agents that are going to lock in that moisture and be able to maintain like the perfect jerky that we have now. It was made into dry meat, and dry mm-hmm. meat's still something that people make, you know, just by slicing meat up and hanging it in this nice dry air that we have in this climate. And that will, you know, the moisture will either evaporate or drip off the meat, and you'll be left with just pieces of meat that are shelf stable because there's almost no moisture and they're food safe. But in that process, there's also so much weight from that moisture being lost because it's all being dehydrated mm-hmm. essentially. Right. And so when I say 7.5 pounds of meat, mm-hmm. that's weight before drying. Right. And so then you think about how many calories people are consuming just hunting and moving heavy things and hide scraping and all of these different tasks that are very labor intensive. And also I think about the surplus of food that was available to Indigenous peoples in order to keep the game culture that we had alive. And I say games, like our traditional games were very, very labor intensive. Like there's a game that Blackfeet women played and other tribes in the Northwest, both on the plains and actually into the Pacific Northwest as well. And it was double ball. And double ball is a game where each player has a willow stick, and then the double ball is made, which is essentially like two weighted ends held together with a strip of leather. So everything's encased in one piece of leather. And so it drapes over that stick. And then you can toss it to other people and they can catch it with their stick, right? So, you know, lacrosse is obviously an Indigenous game from the Northeast. Double ball is an Indigenous game from the plains, but a similar thing. You have sticks, people are catching a ball. And then you have goalposts, which are essentially two tripods with a stick across them. And so you can throw the double ball over the goalpost, which is 1 point, under the goalpost, which is 2 points, or wrap it around that stick, which is 3 points. This is a women's game. And so you have like fields that are a quarter mile long sometimes. And these women are just like running back. Like men are out hunting and women are just like, we're just going to go play this super hardcore game. There's a lot of shoulder checking. Like I've played double ball and like you get the crap beat out of you with these like willow switches. Like, cause people are just like, wham, wham, like trying to catch things. And like someone gets stabbed in the eye. Like it's crazy. But you're also just running and just expending calories for not really any return. Like, this isn't a game that women are playing to trade
for. Yeah, like, war. For fun. Like,
this is just fun. And the fact that that kind of game mm-hmm. culture existed, where people could just burn calories because they wanted to have fun, and they weren't spending all the time, like, we need to spend this energy, like, laboring in the field, or doing, like, all these yeah. productive things. Or if we're not doing that, we're just going to sit down and, like, be sedentary. Like, we had calories to burn. And I think that that mm-hmm, is, mm-hmm. you know, as an anthropology major, you probably understand that that, like, says a lot to the culture of a society, just in terms of the yeah. resources that we had through our food systems. And I think that that plays a lot.
I love that you brought that up. There's this such a damaging, wild assumption that we have in the modern world of, like, anything other than sort of, like, today, like, everyone must have just been suffering and barely scraping by, you know, 500, 1,000 years ago. And it is so not true. And it's this myth that I was taught in anthropology at one point, that came from, like, our inability to, like, really accurately age bones and skeletons. And, like, we're just not good at, like, we're just, like, not good at reading, you know, sites and, like, doing history yet, you know? And so after age, I forget exactly what it is, but age, like, 30 or something, your skeleton really stops changing much and differentiating. And so it's very hard to say, okay, this person was 30 or this person was 45 or 50. And so they would age, they would say, like, adult 30 plus or 35 plus in museums. And so everyone thought you just died, like, age 35. And it's just so not true. And then actually, you know, you look at the sort of the bones and the teeth of people that lived in, you know, the 1800s, and they were so much worse off than people that came before. And anyway, that's a whole other rant. But I just really glad you brought up game culture and the surplus of calories, and that we're talking about, like people that were hunting and, you know, very much engaged in the act of their own survival, and also, like, joy and fun and thriving and community. We just don't hear about that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we can talk about aging of skeletons and, like, obviously in grain-based societies, mm-hmm. you know, it was that transition,
yeah.
you know, in the Middle East, where you had, like, the whole Fertile Crescent history and all of that, the transition from hunter-gatherer societies to communities that became more rooted in place and agricultural communities, and then that introduction of a lot of grains into their diets, and suddenly, wow, these skeletons yes. have cavities.
Yes!
Yeah.
They have heart disease.
And heart disease. And, like, it's very interesting to see that transition. Whereas, you know, we have things like Double Ball, and we had the Run and Scream game, for example, which, if you're babysitting children, is the greatest game to play with them. Have them decorate little sticks and, like, tie beads on them or paint them. Those are their markers. And then the game is literally start screaming and running, and you run as far as you can scream. So as soon as you run out of breath and you can't scream any farther, there you go. That's your marker. And then you just have the kids just, like, run and scream and keep trying to beat each other. And if you have to babysit a whole bunch of kids, like, that's a really good way to burn them out. But also, it's genius. Just running and screaming. And, like, it's just a game that you can just play. It's, you know, there's obviously, like, a lot of endurance and lessons about pacing yourself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can talk, like, war cry skills or anything like that. But it's also just a game of kind of childish, like, silliness that you can just enjoy.
Yeah, it's, like, fun, enjoy.
Having that. And also, you know, you can look at the free time of people that had, you know, these hunter-gatherer traditions versus the free time of agricultural societies. And in large part, you know, having all of that downtime resulted in, like, beautiful artwork and, you know, these different, yeah. you know, just time for enjoyment and games and sitting and observing the world and recognizing, like, these different ways of being. I mean, that's why hunter-gatherer societies have such strong science mentality, because they were able to sit and observe for so long, mm-hmm. right? And whether that was with hunting or whether that was just observation, you can learn a lot about the world from the way other animals interact with it. It's why Blackfeet people have always referred to, you know, wolves and bears and all of these other animals as our older brothers and sisters, right? Because we're learning from them. We learned how to hunt. We learned family societies and structures from wolves. And, you know, there's not too many people that just sit and watch wolves and watch their family interactions and their hunting dynamics and all of these things, but just the ways in which Blackfeet people were able to do that and then model societies after that care. And that structure is interesting, but it's science. It's all science based on observation. And so you can look at science and art and lots of things.
I want to ask you about science real quick before we go back to food, because one of the things that I find so fun to learn about is the ways in which, like, well, I'll back up. I guess I used to think that we lived in such modern times, and I was like, Y2K, and like, we're in the future now. And I've just become so aware as an adult now of like how we're still so not living in this amazingly advanced time. And one of the things that's been interesting about our, you know, so-called scientific discoveries, some of them that I've read about, is like they just affirm things that a lot of indigenous cultures already knew. So for example, I read at some point that the concept of epigenetics was something that was already known and talked about, where basically like the idea that trauma can live in the body and be passed on. And also I think that, you know, joy and thriving and can also live in the body and be passed on, and things even like aversions to certain plants that are poisonous. There's different genes that can be turned on or off depending on, you know, what your life was like when you were in your grandmother's, your mother's, when your mother was in utero. Anyway, so are there other scientific things that come to mind to you right off the top of your head that like you're like, yeah, and here's another example?
That's a good question. I think that one of the things that comes to mind about, you know, especially when you talk about epigenetics and these things that are passed down, is unfortunately like diabetes and gestational diabetes. For, you know, women that have gestational diabetes, you know, have a higher chance of passing on a higher risk factor for diabetes to their children. And unfortunately for Native people, that has meant a lot of susceptibility to type 2 diabetes has been inherited. And that's, you know, of course, a lot of that is this forced shift in our diets from, you know, these traditional high fiber, low carb, high protein, animal fat based diets to what we have now, which is highly processed foods and high carb, high sugar, very shelf stable, not a lot of vegetable content, and all of it is pretty much processed or, you know, all of that. That is a risk factor that's environmental. And then that is then inherited by offspring. And then unfortunately, in so many cases, the environment has to be so strictly controlled because that risk factor is inherited, you know, just because parents were subjected to environmental conditions through colonization of food systems that put their children more at risk than even they themselves were. And so that's something that we're now navigating just with the work that's being done today and some of that research. So that said, there's also, you know, when you look at Indigenous communities, so often we're thought of as places of scarcity. All the things that Native people don't have resources, they're food deserts. And I can talk about like the problematicness of that term, but just access to food or healthcare or whatever it may be. And the success and the knowledge systems and all the resources that we have are not often talked about. And, you know, I can tell you that I see more moose than deer around here, right? There are abundant resources in all of these other systems, you know, clean water, can talk about the elders that we have access to and the knowledge that comes with that. And this multiple generations of place-based information and the folks that know how to use traditional plant medicines to make arthritis treatment and all of these other things, right? There's so much knowledge, and that is things that are abundant here that are scarce elsewhere. And so I like thinking of
deeply scarce
these places as, yeah, and celebrating all the things that we do have so that we can use that to guide us forward rather than trying to sound like a disappointing, sad place. Because truly, like, we have survived a lot, but now we're places of resilience. And that's something that I think should be celebrated in and of itself.
I love that reframe. Can you tell me why you don't like the term food deserts? I'm super curious.
Yeah. So the term food desert is, of course, a term that is defined by the USDA. And it refers to the distance that people live from grocery stores where they can get, you know, fresh foods and things like that. And so it is not the distance that people have to food, right? Food does not just come from grocery stores. You're a rancher. You understand that food comes from places other than grocery stores. You have food.
Yeah, I live in a food desert and it's very abundant here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it's like food doesn't talk about how far you are from a farmer that you can buy fresh produce from. Or sorry, food desert doesn't talk about that, right? Food desert doesn't talk about ranchers that you can buy a half a cow from, right? It doesn't talk about any of these other, like, wow, I live in the middle of the most abundant berry patch ever, and I can pick 5 gallons of berries in 3 hours if I wanted to, very, very, very easily. That, like, there's lots and lots of things, you know, or I could drive an hour into town and pay money for that. So, like, there are lots of factors that it doesn't consider. And also, I think that the term desert, ecologically, like, there's lots of food in deserts too. Food desert and that terminology by itself eliminates the recognition of why there are places why food is more difficult to attain, right? It just kind of throws agency out the window, right? Food desert. Oh, that place just, it just is like that. There's a couple of folks that work in kind of food activist spaces that have used the term supermarket redlining, which, of course, redlining is a term that refers to, of course, the ways in which Morgan maps were drawn, in which they drew red lines around historically Black neighborhoods where they would not allow mortgages. They wouldn't give mortgages to anyone in those redlined districts. They weren't considered appropriate housing that they would give mortgages to. And so that term redlining, it's similar in the supermarket redlining sense because there are actual policies that are put in place that make it harder to have grocery stores in those areas. So I think about a place on a reservation in Montana that they lost their food distributor when COVID happened. The food distributor just said, hey, your next shipment's not coming. You're not going to be on our route anymore. We're dropping you. They had 4 days before their next distribution was supposed to arrive. They didn't have an order coming and they had to find a distributor. And they found one, but that distributor said, you have to pay us a deposit of, I think it was 3 times as much as any other supermarket because you're on a reservation. Why? They're like, why would we do that? That doesn't make any sense. We're a very small grocery store, like that deposit size does not make sense for us. And they said, because you're on a reservation, we won't be able to pursue you in court if you don't meet your buying minimums. One, that's not true. And two, like, it's just supermarket redlining. Luckily, this grocery store was actually backed by the tribe. And so they were able to meet that deposit. But the fact that they had to come up with that money in the first place is absurd. Like, privately owned grocery stores can't do that kind of thing. And if they're on a reservation and they're operating under those systems, like, that is incredibly difficult to manage. And then the other term that I've heard is food apartheid, which just of course, refers to the division of resources and how they are allocated for communities of color and rural communities as opposed to wealthier, more urban communities. And so I've also heard that term applied in urban areas. And so let's see, there's a book about, I think it's Black Food Geographies, which talks about supermarket redlining and food apartheid in urban Washington, D.C. And the neighborhoods in that do not have grocery stores are historically Black neighborhoods. And so, you know, how far people have to travel, often across like geographical boundaries, like rivers and stuff, just to get access to a grocery store, one that's like an actual food grocery store and not just a Dollar General or something like that. And so those are the terms that I have heard people, which assign agency, and they recognize that there are actual policies behind the way things are. And that means that if there are actual policies, we can change them by changing policies, by changing laws, by actually shifting the way these things are done. See, now I'm on my activist
rant. It's such an important shift, and it reminds me, I know, I love it. It reminds me of how we'd say it. We say, like, that woman was assaulted. She disappeared. You know, it's like someone took her. Yeah. Someone attacked her. Who would that have been? It's like how much we build passivity and sort of protective language into things so that we don't have to. I always think of my friend Lizzie, who always says, "Who is it for? Like, who is benefiting right now from this?"
Yeah.
And so I had not heard the term food apartheid and supermarket redlining. So those are really important terms for me to know. Let's talk about the colonization of food quickly before we move on, because we hear about the colonization of land, we hear about the colonization of culture. Can you illuminate folks on some of the ways that food was also used as a tool to colonize and disenfranchise, disempower, all the things?
Yeah. So ever since the United States was a little bitty baby, I was about 2 years old, food systems have been used to target people, right, in this country. And often before the United States became a country on this landscape as well. But George Washington wrote orders to Major General Sullivan to march against the Haudenosaunee Confederacy in the Northeast. And in those orders, he very clearly outlined burn the fields and their storehouses of food and seed banks, and so that they will not be able to plant again, right? Very clearly target the food systems. Don't just burn the villages, target the food. And that was a strategy that was employed because Native people had created these ecosystems where we could travel anywhere and we could get food. Even in places where you were looking at agricultural communities, people still were very familiar with the wild plants. They were still adept at hunting because we weren't using domesticated animals, right? And so all of these things were threats to the United States and settler colonialism, in which they wanted to render the land empty to put settlers on it. And so, of course, Native people's presence was in opposition to that, both from a physical perspective, there are already people here, as well as just a moral perspective, right? You have settlers moving in and saying, like, oh, this is not like truly empty land. And the more you can visibly see Native people, the more they realize that, right? And so there was, of course, this need to render the plains empty, both for people and also for the type of food systems that the United States considered morally correct, which was farming, of course, monoculture, tilling, agriculture, and ranching. And by that, I mean cows and sheep. And there, you know, as long as Native people are there, especially on the plains, like, we're just moving everywhere. Like, we don't want fences. Why? And so that strategy of targeting food systems continued across the continent. So the 1850 Commissioner of Indian Affairs report wrote, "It is cheaper in the end to feed the whole flock for a year than to fight them for a week." Essentially saying, let's force Native people to depend on government rations. in order to do that, they had to wipe out our food systems. And so with that motivating factor, bison were hunted and slaughtered nearly to extinction. You know, we're looking at estimates of 30 to 60 million, depending on whose numbers you're looking at. And then by the time Montana became a state in 1889, we're looking at less than 1,000. That's a massive population decline. And so, of course, that also meant that all the bison genetics that we have now that started when they reached this low point went through a very tight bottleneck. And bison are susceptible to a lot of diseases because of that bottleneck in their genetics. The fact that we still have bison on this continent is miraculous and a testament to a lot of the large-scale recovery efforts that were done. And also, you know, we have about 500,000 bison right now on the continent. That's still a huge decline from 30 million, right? And so they're no longer facing extinction, but also they're nowhere near where they were. Of course, with people that depended on bison for food, clothing, shelter, ceremony, tools, everything, we suddenly lost that. We were forced into dependence on government rations, and that made it a lot easier to control us. And so, you know, for the Blackfeet people, we had a winter where our rations didn't arrive. A quarter of our population starved to death. And in the years that followed, our leaders made decisions to sell off part of our remaining reservation land to be able to buy, you know, cows and more food for the community. So we would never face that severe threat of starvation again. Those lands included what's now the eastern half of Glacier National Park. You know, the fact that Glacier Park was sold for food is not something that's often talked about in National Park Service history or whatever, right? It was because...
Oh, I bet not. I've never heard that.
Yeah, so it was because of that agreement that was made in that those years following the starvation winter that we had to make really hard decisions. And, you know, you can see where I sit in my living room, I can see Chief Mountain out of my window. And that lies exactly on the border of the reservation and Glacier National Park. And it's our most sacred mountain, right? Our leaders made decisions to sell that place so that we would have money to buy food so that I, as a descendant of Blackfeet people that have come before, could exist today. So I look at our most sacred mountain and the fact that that was given up so that I could be here, like that's incredibly powerful, but also a huge responsibility, right? It's, wow, this is how much my ancestors valued my presence today. And also this recognition of the work that has to be done to recover those places and to restore those places. You know, it's why it's so exciting that Blackfeet are releasing buffalo back into the wild on Chief Mountain, and they're able to freely migrate across that park boundary. They're able to be free bison on these lands for the first time in 150 years. Right? That's really incredible by itself, but it's also connected to this tool of power dynamics that have been used against us by the government and the ways in which we have to recover those things. Food sovereignty is about a lot more than just food. It's about political sovereignty and land basis and all of these other things as well.
Let's talk about food sovereignty. I'm so glad you brought that up. Can you, I think it might be a new term for people. Can you talk about some of the tenets of it?
Yeah. So I typically define food sovereignty in the way that it's defined by La Via Campesina and the peasants movement. And that is the right of people to healthy, affordable, culturally appropriate food harvested through ecologically sound and sustainable methods. And then, of course, the right to govern those food systems, right? So it's about food that is meeting your basic nutritional needs. It's about food that's affordable for everyone at every level of the socioeconomic spectrum. And it's about food that you see as food, right? I sometimes say, like, what does culturally appropriate food mean? That's kind of a weird term. You can make menus that are healthy and affordable and entirely insect-based, and not everyone sees that as food, right? If you're making beef-based diets in India, right? That is not culturally appropriate. And then, of course, ecologically sound and sustainable methods, right? whether you want to call that regenerative agriculture, whether you want to call that just a recognition of, let us not damage the lands that we are using to get food. And if the ways in which we're getting food is diminishing our future ability to get food, that's not going to last, right? We need to rethink how we're doing things. And then, of course, you know, for Native people on sovereign nations with sovereign governments, I also identify the right to govern those food systems, right? We have rights to have our own food and agricultural codes, right? We can have our own meat inspectors. We can have our own organic certification standards, right? If they meet the USDA standards, then you can have issues of like cross certification or things like that, or you can export food, I put in scare quotes, like export food to the United States, another nation, right? These are things that we can talk about, but just being able to say like, this is how we will ensure food safety. This is how we will ensure safety standards for our waterways, our landscapes. This is how we will mitigate climate change within our agricultural code. However we want to look at that, that's something that sovereign nations have a right to write and develop and to have those codes. The Indigenous Food and Agriculture Initiative at the University of Arkansas School of Law actually has model food and agricultural codes for tribal nations. Whole bunch of lawyers there that sit down and they write kind of templates. And tribal nations that may not have lawyers that specialize in food policy can take those templates and they can plug in information that is more suitable to that nation specifically, and then they can adopt those. So there are resources out there for nations that are interested in doing this. And I think that that's kind of a cool, it's a cool team of lawyers that do cool things. But also it's tedious work that not everyone wants to do. Yeah.
This is like the kind of thing where I get obsessed. I always say like the kind of sexy climate change work is not always where we need to be looking. Like things like plastic straws, like cool, those are garbage. We definitely like don't need them. But it's so much of this like unsexy backroom stuff of like a bunch of lawyers nerding out on the right language, you know, to put these guidelines together that can actually be really super impactful.
Similar, the Native Farm Bill Coalition went to DC, and during the last Farm Bill, we literally went into meetings and just said, hey, if you took like pages, like had a list of pages, right? All of these things, and added and tribal, every time it said state and local governments, and just added and tribal in that little,
oh my gosh.
You will make so much more money and resources and things available to tribal communities and to tribal governments in the same way that they're available to state and local governments. And just adding that, it's just having that can make a really big difference. But to say that and just be like, yes, we're going to have 5 meetings with congressmen today and we're going to tell them, can you just put and tribal in there? Not sexy. Does not show up on anyone's like
not sexy
bingo tab of food sovereignty. But that's part of food sovereignty.
Yeah. There is a widespread misconception that I think is starting to change, that when the colonists descend on North America, they were, you know, showing up to this untouched landscape. That's certainly what the impression I got when I was taught in school. And you mentioned seed banks earlier. You mentioned that there's more kind of agricultural-based indigenous peoples and kind of other more like hunter-gatherer based. Can you set us straight on just a few examples of what type of agriculture was going on here and why it was invisible to the colonists?
Yeah. So the geographer William Denovan has labeled this as the pristine myth, in which there was this belief that all of nature was once this like very sparsely populated wilderness where humans like didn't really affect it in any way. And that's a very Euro-American mindset, because in many cases, the first examples that they were seeing of this continent was already a generation after massive epidemics of European diseases had swept through before European American settlers arrived there. So epidemics of smallpox came through 20 years before settlers themselves did. They were seeing native populations that had already lost 90 to 98% of our population. And so they were like, well, there's not that many Indians here. Like, we had just gone through like massive population disaster. That said, in the years before that, and before those epidemics swept through, every landscape that Native peoples touched was managed in some way. A lot of that was by very intentional mm-hmm. burning methods. And burning methods can mean everything from burning the undergrowth of forests to help create very passable ways and to burn off a lot of that deadfall that can help just keep healthy ecosystems alive, help make healthier places for those shade plants on the forest floor and things like that. But for Blackfeet people, it also meant burning off the prairies, which helped burn off a lot of that old dying grass at the end of the season. It helped the blackened prairies actually warmed up faster in the springtime because black, of course, gets warmer. The snow would melt. It would trigger those perennial grasses to sprout earlier. So then you have big patches of green grass and the prairie, which is also like a big homing beacon for all of the grazing animals, large ungulates, right? You're like, yes, here you go. This is delicious food here. And you can have all of those things. And also certain plants actually rely on those low intensity fires at the end of the season to germinate. So I think of prairie turnips, which I talked about before. They mm-hmm. have really hard seed coats that you have to break for them to germinate. That can be done through several freeze-thaw cycles or a low-intensity burn, right? It was part of management in that system. Is that considered agriculture, even though we are literally doing something that is triggering those seeds to germinate? No. Like, people don't consider that mm-hmm. planting mm-hmm. those seeds or tending those seeds in any way, but it was really important to those seeds germinating and us having food. And also, that kept the prairies as healthy grasslands. Now you look at places that haven't been burned in the ways that they were traditionally. And unfortunately, you're seeing a big transition to shrubland from grassland. And, mm-hmm. you know, you look at the dominant species and you see so many shrubby cinquefoil and rose hips and sagebrush and things like that. And it's like, those plants can't grow that big if those fields are being regularly burned.
Interesting. Also, then we see huge fires when we actually get them.
Yes.
It's like a massive conflagration that's going to wipe everything out in its path.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a huge Smokey the Bear kind of propaganda for a while in this country, which was no burns ever. Nothing will burn. Burning is bad. And now we're really dealing with the consequences of these places that really we haven't been able to burn. And that's not even talking about all of the traditional burns that people would just set. And that's been done all the way from California to New York, right? People in New York, actually in the eastern woodlands, would actually burn out the undergrowth of the forest to encourage bison to migrate there. Bison were kind of like, by the time they got to Ohio, they're like, this is pretty dense. So people would intentionally manage those landscapes so that the spaces were open enough so that bison would migrate. So are bison a native species in New York? Kind of. They migrated there because native people intentionally managed landscapes that said, yes, come here. We like you. You're delicious. But they wouldn't have come there if people weren't burning. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just too dense. Have you ever tried walking around like hardwood forest undergrowth that hasn't been burnt? It sucks. And so there's like very specific things. But also, you know, you have trails through the forest, right? People would plant berry trees around those trails, right? There's like people that would come in and they would write about like the northeastern United States and be like, wow, these Indians are just like living like abundantly and lazily off the land. You just walk the trails and there's just like plentiful berries on the sides and you can just pick them and snack the whole way. Like those were planted there. Like those are trails that people have been using for centuries. Like those were planted. Similarly, like you see old village sites, like there are nut trees, there are hickories, there are beech nuts, there are black walnuts. Those are, they're all nut trees that were planted right there. So there was just food that grew on trees like that. And then of course, like you can look at traditional mound systems and Three Sisters planting and like all of these things as well. And the ways in which that was done was actually, you know, the trees themselves, the hardwoods were not chopped down. That's a lot of work to chop down a hardwood. But they were girdled. And so those trees would die, which would open up that understory to sunlight. And then you would have a few years of planting in those spaces. You know, you'd have mounds. So they were low, low, low tillage with like hoes just to mound the soil. Prevents evaporative loss, helps just manage those systems. They grow really well together. And then after a few years of planting, often those village sites would move and they'd go somewhere else. Maybe they'd return to those places later, but there was systems of rotational cropping in those places as well. Not to mention they were polyculture agricultural systems that weren't depleting the soil in the same way that let's plant 10 years of corn right. in this field will do. So there's all of these systems as well. There's this idea of wilderness. And I guess the last thing that I'll point out is that when you look at the timeline for when these huge population declines happened due to disease, you can think about all of this burning that was happening in North America by people across the continent. Suddenly, you have 5% of your population left. And there's not enough people to land manage. Everyone's in survival mode. You don't have people that are able to set burns in the same way that they were before. It just, they weren't able to manage those landscapes. They just didn't have enough people. And so people stopped those traditional burning practices just because they had to focus on survival. It was at that point where suddenly the earth is not releasing a ton of carbon from North America, right? There was so much carbon being released just through burning that it was contributing to the warmth of the climate. So look at the timeline of when the Little Ice Age happened.
I don't know anything about the Little Ice Age. I don't know anything about this.
The Little Ice Age is actually the remnants of the glaciers in Glacier National Park. Those are actually from the Little Ice Age. They're not like remnants of the big glaciers that scooped out the valleys. They're remnants from the Little Ice Age. The Little Ice Age occurred from the early 14th century through the mid 19th century. If you want, I can send you literature that basically is like, hey, the massive population declines and the fact that native people were no longer burning actually like really contributed to like global cooling in a massive scale, because we lost the greenhouse gas contribution.
Oh my gosh.
Let me find this for you. And I will send it to you. I would love to read that. You can put it in the show notes. I don't
know. Okay. Oh my gosh.
It's important. It's cool.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'll put it in the show notes. Let's talk about re-indigenifying your diet. We've talked about some of the things that the health effects that have happened due to the colonization of food to Native peoples. What, in just speaking from your experience, what have been the effects of bringing back traditional foods, both, you know, just health-wise, and then also a more on a grander scale, a more spiritual side, or more, I guess, a sense of well-being, a sense of community? Like, just what has the effect of that been to you?
The benefits of re-indigenizing diets are, of course, nutritional, right? You're eating less processed foods, you're eating foods closer to home, you're just generally learning how to cook more fresh foods, right? But there are also a lot of emotional benefits, right? Being able to recognize the foods that are present in your landscape. You recognize those gifts from the world. You have a sense of reciprocity and a responsibility to the landscape, a need to give back, and also just generally able to feel more connected, more rooted in place. And I think that's also something that's really important about this concept of re-indigenizing diets. It's also why I think non-native people can benefit a lot from learning about the traditional foods of the places that they're on. If they're able to recognize the plants, then they feel a sense of responsibility to take care of those plants too. And I think that that's important. And then for Native people, I also think that there is an inherent value that comes with recognizing the wisdom of our ancestors, just being like, holy crap, how did they know all these things? Like, this is brilliant science, whether it's with indigenous land management, whether it's with cooking techniques, whether it's with, you know, just knowing how to work with plant medicines or knowing how to process animals in ways that you could utilize all of those things and actually get nutrients from all the organ meat and hide tanning and whatever it may be. Like, that's really cool to know too. Mm-hmm. And to have that sense of, wow, I come from really, really smart people. Like, all of my ancestors were doctor level smart. You know what I mean? Like, they're all doctorates in foods and knowledge systems. And like, that's something that I think more Native people need to hear, because in so many cases, we're being told like, your communities are places of poverty and they're disadvantaged and you're inherently like climbing this uphill battle. And I like to tell people like, no, look at all these cool tools that you have. And I think that that's something that people can celebrate as well. And then also there's benefits to the ecosystems, of course, when you look at returning bison to the landscape, when you look at indigenous land management, when you look at polycultural planting methods, when you see all of these different things, there's also ecosystem benefits in addition to just nutritional ones.
Something that I have not fully fleshed this out in my mind. I'm just going to like try to speak it out and see how this lands with you. But I've been thinking a lot about like eating regionally appropriate foods, you know, from Montana. And I feel so good when I do that. And we talk about that on the podcast a lot. But I was realizing, I was talking to my mom the other night, and I was like thinking about how as all these European settlers are coming over and colonizing, there was also, how do I say this? Like, we were actually also like losing the cultures that were being left behind. There was like a homogenization of culture happening. And so what it feels like when I would consider like, what would my indigenous diet be? Like, I have essentially no idea and no connection to not just, you know, my ancestors 10 generations ago, my ancestors 4 generations ago, I could not tell you how they lived and their names. And I was just talking to my mom. I was like, what is our food? Like, what are we, where do I come from? What am I supposed to be eating? I guess like, does that track for you? Like, what is that? How does that hit you? Cause this is an idea I'm still like just untangling myself.
Yeah, it's also interesting. And there's so many food stories with Europe and the food influences of like European culture. And so many foods that people associate with European cuisine that they didn't have until they were brought back from the Americas, like potatoes and Irish and tomatoes and
Italy. Gosh.
And there was this whole like weird stigma against eating root vegetables in Europe, which was also very fascinating. Like, people didn't want to eat things that grew underground. I don't know if it was linked to like the devil and Christianity or what. Like, I don't know why people were so anti-root vegetable, but in some places, like in Germany, they actually passed laws that, because they were trying to get people to eat more potatoes. And people were like, no, we don't like these things that grow underground. And so there were villages that passed laws that said, no, there is one oven per village and you could only use it once a week. Each family can only use the oven once a week, which meant that you can't bake bread except for once a week. But you can boil potatoes in your home stew pot over your stove. So it was just trying to get people to eat more potatoes, because potatoes, of course, are not like, they're pretty resistant to giant hailstorms and random things that happen above the soil, right? Whereas wheat kind of gets messed up if it's unhappy in any way. And so, yeah, like it was, there's a whole weird thing there. There's a book called Indian Givers by Jack Weatherford. And he actually wrote about the influence of indigenous foods in world cuisine. And that talks about chiles. It talks about peanuts in Africa. It talks about, you know, potatoes and sweet potatoes. And anyway, lots and lots of interesting things. But the Irish were really the only people that were like, yeah, potatoes, we love these things. And everyone else was like, no, absolutely not. We do not like root vegetables. That is starvation food. We will not eat it.
That brings me, I heard you say this in an interview. You said like a lot of times sort of foods that become baked into what we think of as cultural foods are actually like foods from cultural trauma. And that makes me think of Ireland. I'm totally gonna, I'm just gonna like reference this, but I'm not educated enough to actually talk about it. But I remember seeing an SNL, like, am I pronouncing her name right? Sinead O'Connor, who recently passed away. I'm sorry if I'm saying her name wrong. But anyway, she has a monologue that she did that basically was like, there was no potato famine. They made a potato famine. Like there, we have all these stories of, well, all the potatoes just got blight. And so they had to leave there. And then it's like, oh, wait a second. Like, where did all that come from? And anyway, like I said, I have not actually read up on this enough to like really say this is what happened. But anyway,
the potato famine, the potato famine is a lot more of a story about the colonization of Ireland by Great Britain than it is about an ecological disease. Like, that was a component of it, but it was much more the fact that Great Britain was like, yeah, we're not going to let the Irish have any food. We're just going to take it all. And that had a lot more of an influence on Irish starvation than the actual blight itself. Because, you know, before the Irish had potatoes, they had food too. Like, people weren't starving before. Like, there was a time when the Irish had no potatoes, right? And Irish people still survived.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
There you go.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, Irish potato famine history is very
so much mind-blowing stuff
in and of itself. But it's there's definitely I don't know if you know this, but during the Irish famine years, the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma and the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma actually both sent resources. They sent money to the Irish to be able to buy food, and so Ireland actually has a sculpture to the Choctaw Nation. And I think there's a sculpture in Oklahoma now on Choctaw Nation to celebrate that kind of Irish Choctaw camaraderie. They're both like, hey, colonization's a bitch. Let's share resources. And so they did that, which is a thing.
We see you.
Yeah, exactly. It is a thing.
Oh my gosh. Last question. Thank you, Mariah, so much for your time. Could ask you questions forever. How can people follow you and best support your work?
Yes, you can follow any of my work across social media at IndigiKitchen. So I'm on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube at IndigiKitchen, but I also have tons of recipes available at IndigiKitchen.com. And so people can check out recipes on the website. And I am not a food blogger that writes really anything. You will not get to read my life story. There will be no pop-up ads. I'm very boring. but it does have lots of recipes that are free and
just
easy
the
for
recipes.
Folks to access. Yeah, just recipes. There's videos, but just that.
Amazing. And you're a speaker. You travel all over the world. And so we will link to all your work and links in the show notes. Thank you so, so much for coming on Choose Wisely.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me today on Choose Wisely. I hope your next meal is delicious and your next conversation nuanced. Cheers. Choose Wisely is produced by me and edited by Lauren DeLuca. And thank you again to G5 Insurance for sponsoring this episode. We so appreciate it if you take 10 seconds to rate and review the podcast. That really helps new listeners find us. You can follow us on Instagram at Choose Wisely Podcast, on Patreon at Choose Wisely Podcast, and by email, choosewisely podcast@gmail.com.